This is West Southwest. I'm Andy Robbins, sitting in for Gordon Evans. Coming up, we'll hear a conversation with Dr. Samson Davis, who's part of the New York Times best-selling author team, The Three Doctors. But first, Western Michigan University President John Dunn joins us in Studio B.
Good morning, Andy. Nice to be with you. And Yvonne, nice to see you as well. Thank you.
And with us is also, as mentioned, Kalamazoo Gazette reporter Yvonne Zipp.
Thanks so much for having me, Andy. Dr. Dunn, I wanted to ask about the Everest Institute closing in Kalamazoo as part of a deal between Corinthian and the Department of Education. I'm wondering if there are going to be any wider ramifications for institutions in the area and what the removal of this one for-profit institute might mean.
It's a very good question, and thank you. It's not one that I've spent a lot of time necessarily reflecting on or thinking about. However, I will say this that I always say, and that is that our commitment as a university is to make sure that we're responsive to the needs of students, their families, and others, and that those individuals who are impacted or affected by this and need a great institution to continue their education, we're open, available, and willing to assist in any way that we can.
Do you think that, though, if for-profit colleges are greatly trimmed back or even go away, that what will that mean for higher education generally, do you think?
I think the national picture on for-profit colleges is that they're being closely scrutinized to make sure that they are, in fact, are adhering to high standards with respect to the programs they provide, also the finances and the financial packages that go with the students. And without getting into specifics about any particular for-profit, let me just say that I think there is some clear evidence that some have not been good citizens in the higher education community. They're being called out for that, and I think appropriately so, because all of us should have high ethical standards, expectations of ourselves, and how we treat students and their families and their resources.
The issue of for-profit colleges isn't the only thing on the radar of the federal government with regard to higher education. They've been looking very hard and closely at the issue of sexual abuse on campus. A number of institutions have been identified as needing major improvements in that area. Western is not one of them. Do you think the country has a problem with sexual abuse on its college campuses generally?
Well, certainly the media have done, I think, a very fine job of pointing out incidences that have not been appropriately attended to, females and males that have been assaulted, in some cases horrific things, including rape, and they have we're all being expected to do a much better job of being cognizant of our responsibility. I think the challenge for most universities is that we are in this awkward spot of having a claim made, being respectful of the claim, doing our due diligence as we need to, then also acknowledging that the other party has voice and rights and opportunities. So in some ways, we're being asked to be the judge, the jury, provide the sanctions and all of those kinds of things. And so there's also now kind of a response from students who have been penalized by institutions saying, hey, you mistreated me. You did not deal with this in an appropriate way. The Oregon situation, University of Oregon, is a really interesting one where you have three males that have now been found guilty by the courts of some very inappropriate, bad stuff with a young woman. These are basketball players there. The university acknowledged early on that, hey, we think we got a problem here. The prosecutor, the local prosecutor, said don't move on any sanctions, like removing them from the team and other things, because we're still collecting evidence and it will get in the way of the case. Well, these young men go on, they play in the tournament, the NC2A tournament, they represent the institution in that capacity. And if you were the person offended here, okay, and you're saying, my gosh, my university not doing anything. You know, what about me? I mean, why are these three young men who we all have a good and reasonable belief to think have done bad things, why are they still out there on the basketball court? So all of us are in kind of this awkward spot of how we deal with prosecutors' offices. Fortunately here, I think the relationship with the prosecutor's offices have been very, very good. And I think there are ways you can work through that, but you've got to be in a position where you have good rapport. You can't wait until the incident occurs to establish that kind of rapport and trust. At the same time, you know, I worry about making sure that we are not under-reporting. I mean, technically, we report accurately all cases to the federal government as we need to under the Clery Act and et cetera, et cetera. At the same time, though, I wonder, is there wrongdoing going on that, for whatever reason, our system is such that young women, mostly, sometimes young men, are not bringing forward a case to our attention, and that's not good. So we actually are taking proactive steps on that right now, and we have our own external review going on with some very fine consultants to look both at our documents. How is it that we make people aware that they have rights to report these and a responsibility as well, I might add? And then secondly, is it in the document that our policies that are not right? Or is there something else that somehow is discouraging young people, in most cases, from coming forward and saying, hey, somebody has been really inappropriate with me, either a hostile climate or groping, worse than that. And we want those cases reported, and we want to deal with them effectively, and I think we do. I just wonder, are we getting all the cases reported that should be reported? And we're challenging ourselves on that, as we should.
I wanted to ask about the affiliation with Cooley Law School. And earlier this month, the law school announced that due to dropping enrollments of, it's been reported at 40%, they would not be enrolling the first year class on the Ann Arbor campus and that there would be staff and faculty layoffs. When you embarked on this journey, it's been more than a year now, are you concerned that your partner is not as strong as they were when you started?
Well, first of all, let me correct one thing. I don't know what the exact percentage is of drop-off. I know that there is in the applications nationally to law schools, there's a reduction of 40%. And I think Cooley will be around 2,200, 2,300 students next year. And I don't know what the base was to necessarily calculate where their high mark was, okay? But let me say this, we did careful due diligence as we looked at the relationship and the affiliation with Cooley, and that included looking at financial fiduciary oversight. And so there's nothing here that is inherently surprising or unexpected to us. I think in some ways it speaks to the idea of an affiliation, a relationship building. These are challenging times in higher education, and if you look at other sectors of the market or other places in the country, Thunderbird, which is a very, very fine business school in the state of Arizona, is looking for an affiliation with Arizona State. And Arizona State may end up with two colleges of business within their university. These are very different times. And as I've said from the beginning, our mission and our responsibility, I think, in higher education is to think a little bit outside of the box, to look at relationships, in this case, an affiliation in ways that are helpful, most importantly, to the people we're trying to serve. The students here as well as the students at Cooley. So we remain very excited. We now have ABA approval. We now have Higher Learning Commission approval. And I think on September the 17th, we will be going to Florida, the Florida site that Cooley has, which has been going extremely well, to meet with the regulators there to talk about the affiliation. So, you know, it's a different time. It's not, I mean, at a different scale. Last year, we too had a shortfall. We had to write our budget. These are you know, times that you have to do responsible and appropriate things. I think the Cooley board, President LaDuke, are responsible, and they're balancing their budget. And, yeah, nobody likes to engage in saying to someone, you've taught courses for us in the past, but we really don't have need for your services next year. But again, that's not uncommon in higher education, and certainly not uncommon in the world of business and commerce.
You're listening to West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Andy Robbins. With me is Kalamazoo Gazette reporter Yvonne Zipp, and we're speaking with Western Michigan University President John Dunn. President Dunn, some community colleges in Michigan are either in the process of or granting now four-year degrees in certain areas that are allowed by the state legislature. Among them are Lake Michigan College in Benton Harbor St. Joseph and Glen Oaks Community College in Centerville. Is that development, how's that development going to alter, if it will, the relationship between four-year schools like Western and the traditionally two-year community colleges?
Well, of course, we're very, very proud of what we do in terms of our university and the quality of the education we provide for our students. And we offer all programs being fully accredited by the appropriate bodies. That's something that all consumers should keep in mind as they think about their future. It's one thing to have a degree in business. It's another to have a degree in business from a fully accredited college of business. And it's sad when you have a student who might go out and has a four-year degree in business, but it's from an unaccredited institution or an unaccredited program within an institution that is accredited. That's challenging because employers look at those things very, very carefully. I believe that the limited number, and it's in a very small number of areas where there are four-year degrees that are now permissible, and assuming that the institutions can meet the Higher Learning Commission expectations and accreditation, but it does take on a lot of additional work for the community colleges. There's additional cost to the, for the community colleges to do this, and I worried all along that they may not have fully assessed what those relationships and costs might be. I'm proud, for instance, I think we have one of the finest community colleges in the nation right here locally in Kalamazoo Valley Community College. And of course, they have no appeal for trying to do four-year degrees. Their whole approach has been to think, as do we, in terms of the needs of the student, making sure that transfers go efficiently and that we transfer courses appropriately. And of course, you know, we've established these reverse degree articulation agreements with the community colleges. And I think we now have 19 of those, and those are very powerful. A student can leave a community college without their associate degree, come to Western Michigan University, take a selected course as we transfer those back to the community college, and then they can award the student the associate degree. That's a good partnership. It helps the community colleges. To me, that is very good thinking. And I'm, you know, I still have concerns that, you know, there's some discussion always about, do we have too many four-year institutions? Well, the passage of that law just increased that number potentially by 32 more. And, you know, I don't understand it. I think it was bad policy.
Do you think that part of what might have driven that law is the perception that it's less expensive to go to a community college than to a four-year school?
Possibly, and certainly we heard that. But when you, again, get into the four-year degree, and if you do it right, and you really provide the expectations that employers and others have, the cost for the community colleges will also have to escalate. You can't do it without having people with the appropriate credentials delivering the right kind of stuff that will be responsive to the needs of the market that's out there. And employers are smart and wise, and they'll see that quickly.
We've been speaking with Western Michigan University President John Dunn. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to reporter Yvonne Zipp of the Kalamazoo Gazette.
Thanks so much, Andy.
This is West Southwest on WMUK, information and inspiration for Southwest Michigan. I'm Andy Robbins. New York Yankees shortstop and Kalamazoo Central grad Derek Jeter's Turn 2 Foundation believes so strongly in teamwork as a winning problem-solving technique that it's bringing three New York Times best-selling authors to talk about it in Kalamazoo Wednesday. The Respect Your Community event for adults and young people is being put on by the Foundation's Jeter's Leaders Student Program with help from PNC Bank and the Kalamazoo Community Foundation. WMUK's Erlene McMichael recently interviewed one of the speakers, Dr. Samson Davis, who credits a pact he made in high school with his two colleagues for helping him and them fulfill their goal of becoming physicians, despite negative influences in their inner city community.
Tell me about this event called Respect Your Community.
This event itself is one of many events that's happening that week with the Jeter Leaders, in which the whole campaign is about giving back to the community and respecting your community. It's all about empowering your community And I believe it starts young. And so for this particular event, me and my two colleagues, who we are all physicians and from North New Jersey in a city, we made this promise to become doctors at an early age, and we were able to achieve that level of success. And now we're about traveling the country and promoting education, promoting health, and promoting unity. The whole message is to spread that community vibe throughout the audience, to let the youth know that education is the answer, and to let the adults know how important it is to support the youth along their travels throughout high school, throughout college, and the need to give back and to be a face in your community and uplifting your community to be as best as possible.
I'm really, really impressed to know that three young people would band together to say, we're going to be doctors. How does that even begin to happen?
I met Dr. Hunt and Dr. Jenkins at University High School in Newark in the ninth grade. And right away, we noticed, outside of being in the same classes together, we noticed similarities in each other's style and each other's personality and simple things as it was what type of sneakers each one of us wore. Newark is a tough community. This community full with so much aspiration, and but at the same time, it's very poverty stricken. And so for us, it was a matter of survival. How are we going to find our way out of the situation that we were in? And so we felt that education would be that passport. It was tough because each one of us grew up in single parent homes, and each one of us had no one in our family who ever went beyond high school. So the thought of forming a pack and coming together to support one another became our lifeline, if you will. And so we decided in our junior year of high school, after an opportunity presented itself from a recruiter at a local college to become doctors, that we were going to form that pack. You know, we didn't sign contracts or cut each other's finger or made a blood pack oath or anything like that, but we decided that we were going to stick together, support one another, and champion the situation. And so we made a pack, and we applied to college, and we were accepted, and I started our journey into our future. But we were totally unaware of it, but what we were practicing, what we were stepping into, was this brotherhood that is so important in so many facets of life for everyone to form in order to continue to progress and elevate in life. And that's what you see with Turn 2 Foundation. That's what you see with Jeter Leaders. That's what you see with Derek himself. It's all about teamwork. It's all coming together and being the best individual within your collective team. And as the team grow and as the team succeeds, so do you as the individual.
Did you all go to the same college?
We all went to the same high school, the same college, which was Seton Hall University, and the same medical and dental school, which was Robert Wood Johnson. All New Jersey-based schools. And don't get me wrong, like, there was times where it was tough. There was times where it was difficult, everything from academics to finances to personal struggles and issues from family members getting sick to bad relationships, but we were there to support each other. Once we finished and graduated med school, it was important for us to sort of close that chapter of that promise, but to begin another one in which we felt that it was up to us to put a face to education. It was up to us to put a face to health, so that young kid that's coming up behind is going to say, you know what, I don't care where I come from, I don't care what situation I'm in, I don't care what's my family dynamic, I can go on to achieve greatness, I can go on to be successful. And so having that permission, if you will, in so many ways, to have that face to inspire you is the same as saying a young kid that's growing up who wants to be the next New York Yankee shortstop, they have Derek's face. And so they say, I can aim for that because I see that Derek from Kalamazoo was able to make that happen.
It sounds like by you coming here, you're hoping that your model will be replicated. I myself took a group of girls under my wing from elementary school through high school. We met like twice a month in my home, and they're all in college right now. That's kind of what you're doing. You're showing that anybody can do this. What did that look like on a practical level when you were in school? Did you all have a set day that you got together? What kind of accountability did you hold each other to? Or was it kind of something more organic?
Yeah, it was more organic. I mean, it wasn't methodical at all. It wasn't systematic at all. We were friends. I mean, we were best friends, and we still are to this day. You know, some 25 years later, best friends. So the accountability was not one where I showed up with a clipboard and took attendance. It was one where I showed up because I wanted to be present. And Dr. Hunt showed up because he wanted to be present. And Dr. Jenkins showed up because he wanted to be present. And the fact that if I didn't show up was a reflection of the disappointment that I would cause in those other two guys.
Was there ever a time where you all had to call one another out? Was there any time that any of you didn't want to show up? I'm trying to understand the motivation. What motivated you all?
I mean, that's a very good question. Respect that we have for each other is paramount. Like, I respected those guys so much that if I had to sacrifice something, I would give up maybe going out or not taking an opportunity if it wasn't something that was good for the team, the pack. And so, and each one of us held that same level of respect for our pack. For us, it was about survival, and we came from a very broken situation, so much that it wasn't commonplace to see doctors in our community. So our selections of what to become in life ranged from everything from drug dealer to drug addict, and none of us wanted to become that in life. So when education became the obvious for us, the inspiration became, we have to make this happen because we have no other choice.
This is it.
It wasn't as if this doesn't work, I'm going to go off and be a financial planner. If this doesn't work, no, this had to work. I couldn't go back home because home consisted of 5 siblings in a 2-bedroom house where, you know, everyone was struggling to meet every day quality of life, and people were making rash and bad decisions because the concept of survival was always there knocking at your door, like threatening to wipe you out. For us, that motivation and inspiration came from, one, of not being able to return to our circumstances in Newark. 2, just feeling that we as a group and as individuals felt like we deserved the best in life. We just felt like we were ones in life that was in charge of where we were going, what we wanted to become, and we deserved it. We weren't expecting anyone to give it to us. We weren't expecting anyone to just sort of pass us through. We were willing to work for it. We knew that this was about our survival, that if we achieve this level of success, I think we realized at an early age that it would be a reflection not only for us, but for our families, for the community which we came from, for communities all over the country, to say, hey, this formula works. 3 students from a broken educational system at Seton Hall University, 3 students out of 145 students were biology majors. We were 3 of those 145, and only 45 went on to graduate with their biology degrees, and we were 3 of those 45, and only 8 went on to medical and dental school and PhD programs, and we were 3 of those 8. And so to be in that type of category, we weren't the smartest, we weren't the brightest, we weren't the most gifted, but we had this formula, this teamwork approach that worked and translated into success. And if we could get other youth and other adults even to copy that type of formula, then, you know, the stars is the limit.
Wow. In terms of support, what I hear you saying is that in order to form a pact with a group of people, you need to actually kind of like them. I mean, you need to kind of respect them. And what I'm also hearing related to that is you didn't want to disappoint the group.
Right. And so, you know, I think with that respect for each other, with that respect for your community, it then puts you in a position where no one has to sort of check and balance. No one has to police you because you feel a sense of accountability. And once you have that sense of accountability, that pride, everything kicks in. So instead of you telling somebody to pick the trash off the ground, you yourself will pick the trash off the ground because of that sense of pride and responsibility and ownership that you have, because it's your community, it's your pack, it's your team, it's your success that's on the line.
I'm curious if this model could work with lots of different groups of students. You and your colleagues come from an economically depressed area, single-parent household. Were you all good students? I know it sounds like you were. Were the other 2 good students in high school?
We were good students.
And behavior-wise, you were pretty decent?
No.
That's kind of what I want to get at. There may be some young people who are not going on a good path. Could such a model work for them?
I think this model works for whether you come from the most successful background and have everything you need at home to the most challenging background. Because I think the point about life is that we all are going to have hurdles and obstacles and points of where we want to rise and reach the pinnacle and be on the top and the peak of the mountain. We all want to get to that level, regardless of where you come from and regardless of what support system is in place at home or not at home or in your community. And so I think this formula works to address that sort of challenge, work for you to kind of get motivated and keep pushing, because there's going to be stumble blocks in life where you're going to want to give up. And those who are able to meet those challenges and that fear in the face and move beyond are the ones who's going to reach their level of success. For our situation, it has a lot of dramatic feel to it. So the story itself has been able to blossom into something beautiful, but you don't have to be where I'm from in order to make a pack. You don't have to have the challenges that I went through in life, behavioral or educational or academic or financial, in order to form a pack. Regardless of where you come from, you can come together and bond together and form this team approach. For me in particular, I was a pretty good student, but academics wasn't popular in my community. You get teased, you get called names, you get nerd, and so kids respond to that. That's that peer pressure. You know, it was a form of mental bullying, if you will, that unfolded every day. So kids who were gifted or smart or academically driven in my community started to surrender that in order to fit into the in crowd. So they started to fail on their tests, started to cut up in class, and started to misbehave in order to be a part of their peer circle, because we all want to be a part of something. And so for me, it was the same thing. I wasn't immune to that. So I went from doing well in school to doing social in school. I went from making mom proud to making her disappointing. So I started hanging out at night and got caught up in the wrong crowd, and was, you know, arrested a few times as a juvenile. And it was when I was arrested the last time, when I was 17, for robbery, that I realized that my life was spiraling out of control. I was literally able to sit in my jail cell, remove myself from my body, and look at myself. I was able to see that my life was going to end on the streets if I didn't make a choice, if I didn't take ownership or direction of where I wanted to go. And so, thankfully, I was 17 at the time. I was given, you know, a second opportunity. And when I got back to high school, my senior year, I stopped hanging around anyone else but Rameek and George, Dr. Hunt, and Dr. Jenkins, Rameek Hunt, George Jenkins. Those were the only two guys that I hung out with every single day. I didn't hang out with anyone else because I knew they were on a path of destiny and success. I knew they were focused on getting to that next level. I realized that I didn't have to be another statistic.
You guys have written a couple of books. The first one is called The Pact, and it was published in 2002. Your next one is called We Beat the Street, How a Friendship Led to Success, and that was in 2005. The latest book that the three of you published is The Bond. Three young men learn to forgive and reconnect with their fathers in 2007. The title of that last book is pretty deep. All of them are deep.
So The Bond, I mean, even with the pact, our first book, which at the graduation of med school, is like we have fulfilled our pact. That chapter was closed, but then we felt charged to do something more, to give back to the community. And the pact was our answer to giving back to the community, to come together and put together a book that chronicled our life and the challenges and struggles that we had, and to give it to a person to read. It would give them motivation to keep pushing through, because there's times where you're doing this and you're in school and you feel like you're the only one that's going through a struggle or a challenge or a bad grade on a test. And when you read that, you're not the only one, that other people have been through this, and they give you real life stories of that challenge. And you're like, okay, I'm not an alien. I can make this happen. I could keep pushing through. And then We Beat the Street, it was an adolescent version of the pack, because the pack became very successful, a bestseller, and to this day still is a book that's adopted by many schools across the country as their first year read and their common read experience. And then The Bond happened. The Bond was a book that we felt was necessary, because growing up without dad, sometimes without any parent, sometimes leave you feeling fractured. It leaves you feeling incomplete. And so we grew up without our dads, and each one of us had different levels of fatherlessness. And so we felt that it was important to learn how to forgive our fathers. But before we could learn how to forgive our fathers, we had to reconnect with them. So until you learn how to forgive, then it's impacting you. It's infecting you. It's almost like a cancer that you're carrying around that you're not even aware of. And I liken it to a cancer, because sometimes at the early stages of cancer, you can have it. You don't know that you have it. And so, but it's starting to take ramifications on your body. And so until you learn how to forgive, you're carrying around this hate, this dislike, this disgust for a person. And that's affecting you in your current day relationships and all your relationships that you carry out throughout your life. So once we forgave our dads, it was like almost as if it was a burden taken off our shoulders that we didn't realize we were carrying.
That was Dr. Samson Davis, a member of the Three Doctors writing team, who will speak at the Respect Your Community event. It starts Wednesday evening at 7 in Kalamazoo's Chenery Auditorium. The program is free, but you must pre-register with the Kalamazoo Community Foundation. Visit WMUK.org for details. This is West Southwest. I'm Andy Robbins, sitting in for Gordon Evans, who returns on Thursday. Thanks for listening.